Good evening and welcome to Family Matters. I'm Jill Ajizi. Thank you for being here tonight to listen to this terrific show. This is something we promised you a couple of weeks ago, and our guest had an emergency, and he was so gracious, Carl LeBeau, to be here with us tonight. Of course, my co-host is Judge Michelle Lorenz. Hello, Michelle. How are you?
Hi, everybody. It's great to be here.
I am so glad you're here. We've had such an incredible thing. I want to touch on something that happened last Friday in Illinois, and I'm just going to let you tell everybody what happened in the Dwayne Wade case, who, of course, is a Miami Heat player. Can you talk about that for a second?
Well, I can tell you what happened. Dwayne Wade and his wife were having a custody fight, and part of the testimony, from what I hear, I was not the judge, was that he was an alienated parent. Clearly the testimony was showing, as far as I heard, that the oldest son did not talk or want to talk to his father, and he was awarded custody. So as a result of, and I haven't read it, so I only
right.
know what anybody knows or what the newspaper with the press release says.
Right, and
that
it's
he
all
was awarded
the
custody, and it's in the world of the alienated parent, it's a pretty big deal.
It is a pretty big deal, and I think, you know, the important thing to stress is, and I saw a lot of people writing on blogs, on Facebook, that this was because Dwayne Wade had a lot of money and could sway the family court system. Well, in this case, I happen to know that it was because there was education going on, which needs to happen all across the United States, education of judges and education of lawyers, and there was a decision made because it was the right thing to do, not because money played a part in this decision. And I'm so excited that it happened in my state, Illinois, where we are working to change divorce culture on a daily basis. So it's exciting, and so let's pay attention to what happens from this case, and I think it'll be hopefully a media fervor soon. I was surprised that GMA or some today didn't pick it up because
well, from what I understand, Jill, he is told, from what it says in the press releases, he is told just concentrate on your season, on your work, and taking care of your children, and that's plenty on the plate. We'll see what happens when the season's over.
All right, we'll see. We'll wait and see and hold our breath. One thing I want to touch on before we get to Carl is that in May 21st, coming up very soon, Judge Michelle and I are going to be doing a conference in Chicago. So anybody that would like to attend, you just need to contact us, pay close attention to what we're saying on the show. But we are doing a conference, and it's going to be an all-day conference on a Saturday, 9 to 4. We've got Dr. Mike Bone coming in from Florida. We have Jim Pritikin, Dwayne Wade's attorney, coming in. Judge Michelle and I will present. And it will be an exciting day for alienated parents, for people going through divorce, for anybody who wants to come. So we will give you further details as it sort of evolves and let you know.
And Robert Farrar.
And Robert Farrar, of course, yes, from the CRC, Children's Rights Council of Illinois, so who is just the best statistic giver in the world and was a show guest just last show, and he was incredible. And he's a comedian, too. Maybe we're on like a roll with comedians.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see how our comedian is tonight.
Well, without further ado, Carl, you and I met for the first time in Washington. We're at the steps, the base of the Lincoln Memorial. We're at a rally for parental alienation and all of these horrible topics that deal with children and parents, and you're there, and you're the master of ceremonies, and I'm speaking as an alienated parent, and you start talking to me about what's happening to you, and you're talking about paternity fraud, and I have no clue what you're talking about. So as you told the story to me, I'm just amazed that these kinds of things happen. I lived in my little world in Illinois and thought that, you know, I was the only one that parental alienation was happening to, but then I learned that there's this paternity fraud thing that's happened to you. So welcome. first of all.
Thank
again.
You so much. Yeah.
And I want to talk to you about what happened in your case. So you were married, and then what happened?
Well, that's how it all starts, isn't it?
Yeah.
I want to say, you know, I think it's absolutely wonderful that we met some 3 or 4 years ago, one day on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, which for me was my coming out party. I had been alone in my journey for some 15 years at that point and had no idea anybody was fighting for family rights and shared parenting and paternity fraud and all those things. And as life worked itself out and as I spoke out publicly about what was going on for me, to be slowly moved along to meet the groups of people and your friends and you and everyone that was involved that particular day have all become friends of mine and have all kept the battle alive to where now I'm on your radio show with Judge Michelle and listening to something that educates and gives those people hope that are out there that are going through this by themselves. I know you felt alone in your journey, and
Absolutely.
I thought no one had lived what I was living. And at that rally, I met hundreds of people that shook my hand and talked to me about their problems and how they were handling them and what they were doing about it. And I was so, when I left that day, my life changed because I met so many people like myself. And that was the greatest day of, at that point, you know, many, many years of dealing with paternity fraud and alienation from a child and all those things that I'd been through in that journey. So,
what I like about what you're saying, Carl, and what the three of us have in common, and one of life's great truths, is all societal change happens with somebody getting screwed. Now, it's horrible that it was you, and it's horrible that it was any of us, but that's how change starts, with people deciding that they're going to make a difference.
Well, you know, none of us planned this when we were teenagers. None of us said, oh, gosh, I hope I get to a point in my life where I can speak out against, you know, the bureaucracy or the laws. Or, that's not our goal. Where most of us have, you know, have that dream that we just strive for, and along life's way, things happen. And
but, you know, Carl,
next thing
you know,
know
what I like about your – you have a video on YouTube that I absolutely love, because you talk about – how you moved around when you were growing up, that you thought success was going to be making lots of money and being in the spotlight. And then things took a turn for the worst. And forgiving is a big thing that comes into play in parental alienation and paternity fraud. And now you are an advocate, and I am an advocate. And what you and I are doing is taking what we were handed. And what I really wanted to say was what your mother said to you. Your mother said, I knew you were destined to do something great. And that's what I feel about you and I. You know, we've been handed this bad deal. But we're trying to make, as I always say, vinegar into lemonade. We're trying to work through what we have and make it so that nobody else has to go through what we have had to deal with.
I want no one's child to ever feel what I've been through.
People don't know. Let's talk about you. We'll go back to you were married, and
yes,
it was a short-term marriage.
I was married 5 years.
Okay. Oh, that's not so short. That's real.
No. In Hollywood, that's like 12.
No, I was in dog year, Hollywood.
Like I'm married in dog year. Oh. Yeah.
So you were married, and then what happened?
Well, you know, as the marriage started to fall apart, the idea of starting a family was just very important to me at the time. I was at a point where I was making lots of money. I lived in Malibu, California. I was surrounded by 6 estates, and I was the only thousandaire that lived there.
That had to feel good.
Yes, it did. I lived next to Roseanne's summer home and the Disney Mansion, and just some phenomenal estates, and I got to live there 1 week out of the month. I lived on the road touring as a comedian with my good friend Sam Kinison, and we toured the country on a 3-week basis every month. So it was my one place of safety. And I, when I was there, it hit me that it was time to grow up and start a family. It was a great opportunity, and I would be able to support that lifestyle and that change. And so we had a beautiful little girl, and a year later it had fallen apart completely. Drugs were a part of the scene at the time, which was the 80s, and it really took its toll on a couple, and I'm not going to blame her for this or that. It just was, and it was up. I couldn't go any further. I cleaned up my life, and so I filed for divorce. And after that, it was really alienated from getting to visit my daughter. So over the course of the next 3 years, I got to see her less than 10 times.
Is that because visitation was denied, obstructed, excuses?
It happened because of when I'd make a plan, I'd book a gig out on the East Coast to go visit, and it was all set and said and done, and then the child wouldn't be available to me. They were going on vacation. It was always an excuse, and I'd get her for one day out of the whole week that I was there, those kind of things where I didn't get to see her much.
And you loved her. This you thought was your child.
Well, I had her for a year. I watched her take her first steps. I saw her, say her first words. And as any parents know, the miracle of childbirth, and then to watch a kid turn into that little personality, where you start to see the do's and don'ts that they come up with, and their little eyes spark up when they learn something.
Yeah.
All that beauty that every parent just dies for, to see that growth. That was a part of my life, and. Her first words were bird, and she had birds by her window, so I fixed up the house so that the birds could only land by her window. And that way, every morning, she'd wake up and see the birds, and that was her first day. So that's those memories I'll never, never lose. They're ingrained, and she was a great child, and I had to make the decision of her mother's health and health for my group, and it was all drug related, so I separated from her mother and knew that she'd get help around her family more than she would around our particular group. So thinking that might be the start, it just turned into something where I just didn't get to see her at all, and I didn't know that there was a reason she was holding the child away from me at the time.
Let's talk about when you found out that you were not Angelica's father. How did you feel, and what was that conversation like with your ex-wife or wife at the time? I don't know if you were divorced or in the process.
Right. I called because I couldn't make my payments. I couldn't come up with the money. I was paying over $2,000 a month for about 3 years when Sam was alive, because we made lots of money, and I was happy to do it. And then after Sam died, my whole career changed. I mean, I was Sam's head writer, his opening act, and we did everything together. And then after Sam's death, I found myself working clubs for the money I'd make in a week. I used to make in one night. So my whole income had completely changed. And I was having trouble a year later after Sam's death making the particular payment. So I called her up to see if we could work it out to split it up into two payments. And that's when she broke down and told me that not only was Angelica not my child, but she was Sam's. So how it affected me, I went into a spin, a psychological spin, because I think any time we get hit with a surprise in life, especially one that pertains to something so close to our hearts, this was my dream, was to have a family, and that was stolen from me in one sentence.
Wow.
Every single thought of anything that my friend Sam had ever said to me was now in question. So now a 15, 14-year friendship, what else did he lie about?
Stabilizes your whole reality.
The whole reality. Anything my wife ever said to me, anytime she ever told me she loved me, any of those things were now in question. And it put me in a spiral where my equilibrium was off for a while. I wasn't myself at all. I was trapped in an unreal world, as I ended up calling it. I couldn't fathom the treachery, or I couldn't fathom not telling someone that this was the reality, you know, years earlier when it happened, because that's not who I am. But it was just it drove me to a side to myself that I never felt so lost in my life.
How did you go about trying to heal that, and how did you do that? What was your process?
The first process was self-destruction. Since I didn't trust, it gave me trust issues too. I was in a new relationship of about a year. I'd been single for about 3 years, and I was in a brand new relationship, and all of a sudden I found myself with trust issues, intimacy issues, those kind of things, because I had the rug stolen out from under my feet in life. So that created a wall of distance between the most wonderful woman I'd ever met in my life. And so her and I were even though she was helping me through. I'm sorry?
You think she's, as you look at it now, do you still think that she has wonderful parts to her?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm talking about the new girlfriend I had met that I was
with
for 15
years
after all. Yes. No, I don't think I can answer the other question.
Better
not.
But, you know, what I have learned is that people make mistakes. And in my downfall as a solid person who's always relied on my trust in spirituality and my trust in my own judgment and those kind of things, that's what it threw off. And what I realized is I had to learn to forgive the actions of my friend and my ex-wife, or else it was going to destroy me. It was not destroying them at all. They didn't know, you know, A, my friend was gone. He was dead. And then my ex-wife had no idea what I was putting myself through. So I wasn't doing myself any good by sabotaging my own life. And I think it's very common for people that go through such a traumatic event to either rely on alcohol to go to sleep or to, you know, you catch yourself doing the bad things that are self-destructive because you're so lost. No one can answer. No one can heal you. No one can say the one thing that heals you. You have to find it yourself. And that was a journey that lasted about 7 years for me. And it was one night I just got it. One night I just got that I had to let them go and I had to let it all go in order to respect myself again and try to do something about it.
How long ago was that, Carl? I mean, was that...
That was 2000.
Okay.
That was 2000.
But you let it all go, but it kept coming at you.
It kept coming at me.
Right, and still is today. So what happened then when you had this aha moment that you have to let them go and forgive everything that happened, but you were dogged then by everybody. So let's talk about what happened after that.
Well, as you can imagine, in the situation of finding out that there was a lie involved and that a secret had been kept from me, and having to listen to the rumors that fly around Hollywood and all those things that I had to go through as a person, to have my name slaughtered, to have child services after me, I made the decision I wasn't going to pay for a child that wasn't mine anymore. I even told my ex-wife.
Just to slow you down, because not a lot of people know as much about the story as they would like to. So you found out that this wasn't your child, and then you knew you had to try and stop the support because that was an error. And what did you do to try and get it stopped?
It
didn't work.
I got a lawyer through a friend, and I was excuse me. I guess it's hard to explain because that's a part of my case that I'm going to be trying to show what happened. But I had a lawyer that took 6 years for me to get a divorce.
Okay.
And in that time, I guess it's a lawyer's trick from the opposition to make it last as long as possible till you give up. like that law of attrition where I had no money. I was barely getting by as a performer, not to mention my, you know, my psychological aspect of trying to be funny every night had been gone for a while just because of what I was going through. So work was very hard for me to come by. And my ex had, you know, money from her family and had a great lawyer that just kept it going, going, and going until I basically gave up under the effects of being an alcoholic at the time.
Got it.
So I kind of woke up years later and realized what had happened is really one of the aspects of this.
Okay. I got you.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But,
yeah, it was just...
How long did you finally get the support stopped?
No, never got it stopped. Settled in on just signing whatever they wanted me to sign. It was
and
they won.
So the arrearage kept accruing, huh?
Oh yes, and I got hit with a $30,000 back order from all the years that I had paid, but I had paid on my own. I hadn't paid through the courts. I had paid just on my own, and none of that was allowed in. And I had to start all over again, and I owed all the money all over again.
So
and
you
I
were
just
at
caught,
about $187,000, isn't that right, Carl?
Well, it's accrued now to that amount.
Yeah.
I'm sure if they were to look into it, how much of that is penalties, I don't know. I found out how that works. You know, you miss a payment if a person loses a job or they're injured. One of the things that I have learned from meeting so many people that have been called deadbeat dads is they just lost their job. And, you know, 2 months down the road, they get a note saying, yes, you owe $500 a month, but now because you haven't paid in 2 months, you owe, you know, $2,500 because of penalties. And when you don't have a job and you don't have any savings, that's impossible. So that just adds up and adds up and adds up to where you're financially under the gun.
And if you throw on top of that, the loss of your driver's license and your passport, which really limited your ability to travel anywhere, to do shows, to make more money,
correct,
to try to rectify what you thought was.
I lost all that in correct. I lost all that in 97, and I lost my driver's license and my passport in 97, and you know I'm a comedian. I travel. I do gigs. I do. I lived in Los Angeles, so I would drive to San Diego and do shows. I would. You know, you can imagine all of a sudden not having a way to get around. And it's not just that affects the person or affected me or anybody going through it like I am. It affects your psyche. It affects your manhood. It affects your confidence. It just destroys your confidence because you have to rely on other people to get you somewhere on a constant basis. If I wanted to go to the store, I had to call a friend to drive me to go to the store. If I needed to buy a shirt for a show, I had to wait for someone to pick me up. If my parents were sick, if my mother was sick, I'd have to find a way to get there that no one else had to go through the hassle that I did. So it really, you know, not to mention all money was taken out of my bank account for many years also to where I had to quit banking because they go into your bank account and just empty out your account.
So was your, the daughter who you thought was your daughter, was she receiving this support or was it going into other?
I don't know. You know, at the time I had lost contact because I didn't know her, but 10 days after her first birthday. I had her for 1 year.
Yeah.
And for the next 3 years, she was kept from me. Now I understand why. Her mother didn't want her to see her growing into the likeness of her father and picking up on that at the time. But I had no contact with her, so I didn't know her anymore. Since I found out she wasn't mine, I let her mom raise her the way she wanted to, hoping she would tell her daughter who her father was. And you know, I'd be there later in life. I always thought that. It's like, you know, if this child, if this young woman ever comes to me, I'll be there for her as someone who can give her the answers as to who her dad was, you know.
And we're going to talk about that in a little bit, about the kind of relationship you have with Angelica now. But there is sort of a dark side to all of this with Sam's brother, Bill Kinnison.
Correct.
who came in. Right. And so I'd like to talk about that aspect of it. What did you know about what Bill was doing and how that affected the rest of your life?
Well, you know, realizing that there was a group of us that traveled and did all the shows, we performed up to, you know, 30,000 people a night, mostly 6,000-seat venues the last several years, and Bill had come on board, Sam's older brother, as our road manager.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how much of this I can talk about, but I... as far as, because this is something I'm bringing up in my court case, but there was...
You know what, just think about
it
for a moment. Don't get involved and do something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know how
exactly.
We all are as human beings, we get engaged.
Well, it's an interesting story, and we want to know the depth of it. And that's the problem when I see the press from the first stories after filing this case, is the fact that, you know, the press is allowed to create what they think the story is going, but they don't have all the information yet. So
I'm not allowed to give all
the information yet. That's all.
It's a lot like a character assassination in a parental alienation case, Carl, when history, revisionist history, is presented to a family courtroom and that target parent is portrayed to be something that they're not. And that's exactly what is happening in your case. So we'll put Bill aside and we'll say that something incredibly interesting happened, and that'll be for later, and people can kind of sit on the edge of their seats and wait for that facet of your story.
You're very good.
Thank you.
She's never one to miss the opportunity.
No, I never miss an opportunity. We always want to, you know, bring them back in later. So all of you that are listening, there's a really cool part of the story that you're missing.
A friend of mine once said, by the way, he said, you know, as far as movie scripts in Hollywood, they've never written one like this because it's never been heard of before. The twists and turns in this story and how I survived it is I can't believe it sometimes. I look at it on this side of it and where I'm at right now and how I feel as a person and a human being, the survival to get through all this has been quite a journey. But I'm so glad I did, and I'm so glad I came out of it on this side of it intact with the same values I was raised with. I got back to all of it, you know. And my concern is for Angelica and her to be received and own her name. She's been raised to be humiliated and embarrassed as to who she really is and confused. And so a part of our journey was for me to heal her, to give her closure. And that's the part of the journey I'm sure we can talk about in length.
Well, I like to talk about that because what you've done is, through what you've gone through and gone through that kind of agony and humiliation and shaming as if you were one of those people who would abandon a child and not pay and to be standing in a courtroom and people thinking that's true, that's really tough. And yet you've found a way to make it very important to rescue her if she needs it.
That's why I'm, you know, no matter what happens to me in all of this, that's my sole purpose. Angelica never did anything wrong. She was raised to think that she did. She has, you know, she had very confusing thoughts about me and Sam, and the clarity for her was never there. Her mother was never quite honest enough with her as she grew up. So, you know, when I met her, which is an interesting story. This was 3 years ago, and I was in New Jersey doing a show in Orange, New Jersey, at a club that I love to do down there. And I was about a minute away from getting on stage, and the doorman came in and said, "Carl, there's a young woman that wants to meet you." And I said, "I can't. I'm walking on stage in like 30 seconds." And he goes, "Well, this is kind of important."
Oh, my
God. And I caught his tone, and I said, "All right, well, bring her in." And I'm getting ready. I'm all fired up for this show. And in walks this young woman who turned 18 the day before and graduated high school. And she walked in and she goes, "Hi, Carl, I'm Angelica." And she just stood there with this face like she was afraid I was going to ask her to leave. And I just had a flash of, you know, the last time I saw her, which was she was about 3.5 years old, this little bitty girl, you know. And here I was looking at this woman. And I couldn't believe it. And I said, can I hug you? And she goes, yeah. And we hugged, and we both started bawling like little babies. And we're crying, and the guy walks in. He goes, Carl, you're on.
Which is funny right there.
It'll be funny.
Yeah.
It'll be funny now.
So I grabbed her hand. I walked her out into the audience. I set her down in the chair, and I said, this is for you. And I went up on stage, and I had one of those shows that in my business, when you can get on stage and not even have to think, it just pours out of you. It's
mm-hmm.
it's the most magical moment. That's why I do it, because those moments are there waiting for you. And I did. I walked into one of those moments, and it was all for her. And I remembered while I was on stage, the last time she saw, when I got off stage, she said, oh, my God, I can't believe what kind of performer you are. I've heard about you my whole life, but, you know, just to see you, she goes, I've never, you know, you got to realize I've never seen you. I go, actually, you have seen me. I go, when you were 2.5 years old, I had to take you to a show because your pickup hadn't arrived from a day that I had you. And I took you to the park, and I took you to some rides, and then your mom didn't show up in time, so I took you to my comedy club. And I set you in the very back booth with a friend of mine while I performed. And my first joke, or the first story that I told that came out of my mouth, the crowd laughed, and then they were done. All you could hear was a little two-year-old in the back laughing at the top of her lungs, and it made the whole crowd turn around and look back. We were like, who's got a baby in here? And so I realized what was going on with the audience. I said, I'm sorry, everybody, but my daughter's in the back waiting for a pickup. Angelica, why are you still laughing? And she goes, because my daddy's so funny. And the place broke up.
Wow.
I go, so you've seen me once before. So anyway, that's the night we met. And after that, I started trying to get to New York area every 3 months. And we slowly started to visit. And I found out that she wasn't being supported in her visits to come see me, and she had been told a lot of different things. And I think a part of alienation that I've also learned is that when one parent has the child all the time, you can create a monster out of the other parent, and that is what had happened with her. She had been told so many different stories that I wouldn't have come to visit me if I would have heard these stories my whole
life.
Well,
let me ask you,
I really wouldn't. Yeah.
Can you weigh in for our listeners about the crisis question, the pivotal question is, when you think you're doing more harm by forcing contact with your child, because every time you call your child and then your child gets put in some sort of loyalty bind by the alienating parent, is it your opinion that the parent should keep showing up and keep showing up, or give the child reprieve? How do you weigh in?
Gosh, it's such a tough place to be, because
I know.
I think, as the parent, you know, you realize what the child's being put through, but I think it's also your responsibility as a human being to teach them the difference between right and wrong. One of the promises I made Angelica when I first met her is I was never going to talk bad about her mother. I said, so no matter what you say to me and no matter what you tell me your mom said, I'm not going to respond to it, and we're going to make a decision now as two adults that no matter what your mother says about me to you and it upsets you, I'd rather not hear those things, because you and I have our own relationship and it's going to be based on truth and honesty.
Good for you, Carl.
I didn't have you in my life. There's a lot of catch-up that I can tell you about your real father, about his great qualities, about his drive, about his positive attitude in life, and all those things that are inherent in you. And those are the things that I will give you. I'll never put you in a situation where you have to make a judgment about your mother. So that
and
was
what,
my
and
choice.
What a great thing for you to say, knowing how Sam betrayed you, knowing how your ex-wife betrayed you, but you were willing to turn the other cheek, in a sense, and
yeah.
just take the high road and be able to tell Angelica what a terrific guy her dad was and how wonderful a mother she had. And,
yes.
and I just applaud you for that, Carl, because if everybody would do that, we wouldn't be even on the show. We wouldn't be
but
having
would,
the show.
No, you know how I feel about the turn your other cheek. I think it's the way I put it, which is just a little differently, is knowing that to detach and let, if somebody has wronged you, it's
yes.
life's job to take care of whatever they've got.
That's right.
Don't have coming. It is not our job to enforce emotional justice. And when we think it is, we destroy ourselves and everybody who's around us. So it's more like unhooking and letting whatever the situation, take care of them. When we try and do it, we stay more attached to them in the neural pathways of our brain than we ever could imagine. So,
well, you know, there's an old saying, whoever has not sinned, throw the first stone. Well, you know, Sam and my ex-wife, you know, this was drugs, alcohol, the 80s rock style life and all those things. And what I got to one day when I cleaned up my life completely was that I had made a lot of mistakes myself. I had hurt a lot of people with my behavior, and I wasn't the most professional of people. And that's when it, you know, it's like, what am I doing judging these people so bad when they probably couldn't tell me because they were never in the right mind to tell me. They made mistakes too, but Angelica didn't. So there's no reason to have her carry guilt in life for all this mess that went on around her. Once I found out that she had guilt issues, once I found out that she felt embarrassed to be around me, she got to realize this poor girl had told her friends that she thought she was the daughter of Sam Kinison, and they laughed at her because to them she was just throwing up a name of a celebrity.
Oh, really?
Yes,
yeah,
and
I
can
see where that would happen. Is there a component of your relationship now that's father daughterish?
How we've labeled it is that I said I am your father's best friend, and your father's gone, so I'm like your godfather. I'm going to be there for your questions. I will be there for when you need a father figure, when you need somebody that's, you know, I'm very rational, and she just loves it. She calls me and asks me questions out of the blue just about relationships and things, you know. And I would know that Sam would do that for me if it was reversed. If I had died, Sam would be taking care of my daughter. I mean, that was just our friendship, you know. So,
have any relationship with her over the years?
I'm sorry?
Did he have a relationship with her?
In hindsight, which is a good friend of mine now, hindsight, he was very afraid to hold her. He was very afraid to connect with her, and I always thought it was very odd when we lived back at the house. You know, Sam and I never lived more than a mile apart. We had so much work to do. We always lived right next door to each other, and I remember handing him the baby once to hold for me, and you would have thought I handed him an ice cube and told him to put it on top of his head. It was just such an odd visual for me to see him just react the way he did, and now I know why. You know, he was hiding something that was killing him and driving his abuse.
Do you think, Carl, he knew right from the inception that it was his child? How soon into the pregnancy did he know that Angelica was his?
Yeah, I think he knew all the way back.
All along.
Yeah, all along.
Well,
and,
to let you know how things are, and you know this as well. My birth certificate father, I later found out, wasn't my biological. Same thing.
Wow.
But the shame around that, the paralyzation of people just not knowing what to do. And you never know how it is they got together. There's no excusing it. You never know what night or what drugs or what. And how they fell into some dark place for that night, and then the cover-up, because people are clueless, and is it going to hurt the child more? How do you do this? But it looks like your situation had a little bit more, perhaps, malevolence than a regular situation. But
For me, I just realized that I couldn't control any of this. You know, I was in a, you know, Sam was a, you know, pretty famous comic now. I mean, to me, he was just my friend. But after his death, of course, he's been voted the 20th funniest guy ever. And
he was
super
major guy. He was right up there with Richard Pryor. And
Exactly. You know, his comedy was right from the heart, and of course he had a great twist to it. But I mean, it was all planned. It wasn't like he was just raw and unnerved. He really knew what he was doing in the performance world. And so for me, you know, to go through that and then have Hollywood have to put me through this situation where, oh, he never, you know, they weren't really good friends. Sam just used Carl. Sam just did that to Carl. So look what Sam left Carl with. All those things that I had to go through and grow through, and realize none of that's important. It has nothing to do with anything. Right now, it's me getting my life back and me setting Angelica on the right path to owning who she is in life and enjoying an adult life after what she's been through.
Well, I
love and to help as many people as possible that are like me that have found out their children aren't theirs. You know, that's the other thing too.
Carl, what are you doing now to do that? Who are you helping? What affiliations do you have with organizations that work on this type of thing, paternity fraud?
Well, the ACFC has really come into my life, and you know, Michael McCormick has become a one of my best friends.
He's such a great guy.
Oh, he is, and he, you know, this guy's been battling many issues. I love talking to him because he's a prevalent of information. This guy knows more about paternity fraud cases and child alienation cases and everything. I can't handle that much information in my brain, but he's a computer. There's a passion for him. And those are the guys that, you know, if anybody's going through what I'm going through, the ACFC.net network is where I eventually grew into. I think they're the fairest of some, you know, of the people that I've met. I don't know all of them, but my journey led me right into them, and it led me right into you in Washington D.C. And you know, I get emails from families, guys going through what I've been through now. It's their second family, and how their lives are destroyed. They have to work two or three jobs. They have liens on everything that they make, which I totally understand. I'm in the same boat. And, you know, but I don't work a job where I go to the office every day. I'm in a different state every week. So it gives me the opportunity to speak out and not, you know, be as much harassed as they are. But I still get harassed. It's affected my jobs. They used to call clubs, child services called clubs, and just harass them for the whole week that I was there. And the clubs wouldn't hire me back. So I've been through years of that. Every time I've spoken out, I've had some kind of backlash, and now I have DNA proof, which I never had before. And so after 15 years, I have proof that I'm not the father and that Sam was. That's the proof that I just got 6 months ago.
I guess a lot of people would be asking, Carl, right now, why did it take so long to get DNA evidence to prove that you weren't Angelica's father?
Well, one thing is the family didn't want to give me DNA from Sam's family because there's an estate involved.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was never something that was offered. And Angelica even called the Kinnison estate and introduced herself. They knew who she was. They were very happy to talk to her. But as soon as she asked for DNA to prove if Sam was her father, they never returned her phone call. So that was a year before I met her. And when I did meet her, she said, what's most important to me is, A, if I find out, I want to find out if you're my father first, because I want you to be my dad. And that
broke
my
heart.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably going to end up that way.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have other children?
We're adults now. No, I don't have other children.
Well, there you go. Look at the path that you found each other in.
Yeah.
Look at that.
She's been through just as much as I've been through, so we really have that understanding of each other.
And she
needs
on some level, doesn't she?
Oh, sure.
I think she really does.
Yeah. I mean, her father's gone. So, you know, we've had calls where it would be 11 o'clock at night. I'll just be getting off stage, and my phone will ring. And she goes, I don't mean to bother you, but what was Sam's favorite music?
Oh.
And I got to think for a minute. And I get her. She goes, okay, because I'm just trying to download some stuff just to find out what he liked to listen to.
She's
that kind of stuff. And she goes, I'm really sorry, but what's your favorite music? You know, that
kind
of
stuff.
But I was
going to say, she's using it as an excuse to call you, so just to be attached to you.
Exactly.
So whatever she has to do, but, you know, I'm sure that's a big piece of this. And like you said, then she said, what's your favorite music? So I know that that you have a position about shared parenting, and that somehow being around the people who are supporting you, you've learned a lot of tangential subjects. So what is your position about the shared parenting?
Well, you know, I think it's so important for – I think that one thing is I think we need classes in high school to teach people how to deal with the failure of love. We're all taught how to cook in school. We're taught how to, you know, exercise, But no one's ever taught about when things fail or when things when you grow away from each other. What happens when you're not 18 and you're married and then now you're 29 and all of a sudden your mind strays away from your relationship and it ends? How do you handle the responsibilities you've started as a family? No one's schooled that way. It's easier to blame the other person for affecting the child's life, and it turns a very ugly situation, especially when lawyers get involved and realize there's money to be made for years by this. So that's the sad part, is that there really is no help. It really has to stem from the two parents. And I wish that there wouldn't divorce, but you had to go to some kind of intermediate, a person in the middle that could talk to both of you and realize, you know what, you're both great adults. You're both very mature people. Don't get caught up in the hating part of this thing. Get caught up in the care and concern and love of the child, and let that child have dad's point of view for 3 days and mom's point of view for 3 days, and let them grow up and make their own minds up about how they want to be in life. To be so one-sided, I've met so many, you know, like Angelica and her friends, you know, a lot of them, they don't like boys. They don't, because they were raised with just the mother who downplayed men the whole time. Or the opposite, where, you know, women are evil from some guy who's been through hell and he doesn't want to talk to his son about, you know, the fairness of letting his son be with mom.
So is part of your agenda getting skills for communication and conflict and real marriage?
Go ahead. I mean, it's just something that hit me a couple of weeks ago.
I'm so with you, you can't even believe it. And especially, the divorce rate is 50%, 70% for second marriages. How can we leave these kids armed with no skills? The generation coming out of the school now is the first generation coming out of divorce, completely conflict-averse, having fear of having conflict because when they experienced it, with their parents, their life blew up. You need to have the skills to do it, or you can't make it in relationships. Not only where they're getting them.
Yeah, you know what? This whole generation has been raised with one parent anyway. So, you know, school systems are what latchkey kids, I guess it was. What'd you call that?
Latchkey,
in the 90s.
Right?
Yeah, latchkey. You know.
Well, how's your career going?
My career. You know, what's unfortunate is, I've never been funnier. I've been through the biggest hell in my life, and I've never been funnier.
Well, is there anything you could tell us about how to maintain humor when you're really in the trenches and really, you know, deep in despair? How do you find the...
Well, I'll tell you where I get the strength from is my parents were divorced twice growing up, once when I was 9 and once when I was 18. My mom and dad made a decision that it wasn't going to affect the children. So both times, they remarried twice, you know, or once.
I do not recommend this for anyone who's listening. I did it. It doesn't work well.
Yeah. Well, they decided for the love of the children to get back the second time, which we didn't know. And my mom and dad made sure that we knew that we were loved growing up, and so it all comes from the skills of my parents of how I survived all this, and it just hit me one day.
Were they funny?
My father was hysterical. He had 5 other brothers, and they were all Louisiana Cajuns. So, as you know, we also traveled in the Air Force. So I moved every 2 years. I had to make friends every 2 years at a whole new school and a whole new situation, a whole new country. And Dad made it so much fun, and Mom nurtured. So she allowed us. My mom had a bladder problem. If she laughed too hard, she would pee. And once we found that out, well, then all 3 of us kids became very funny.
Because, you know, the truth is, Carl, you know, every other week Jill and I do this show, and we do it on the deepest, most dense subject you could imagine.
Yes.
And it's hard to access the humor. I mean, when I write about my deep, dark, dense stuff, it's all black comedy.
Yes.
But it's really hard for people to find that. I wish we knew how to communicate, because you to say don't take yourself seriously, you can't really say that to someone who's who's lost their children for a time.
Right. Right.
So tell
well, the other side of it is you get
your kids,
one. Well, you know, I made a statement when I filed this case a couple of weeks ago. I made a statement that just popped out of me. I did the Joy Behar show, and
yeah.
and she's a fellow comedian, and so it's one of those situations where, you know, my life is about writing about what I live and then turning it into humor so that people go, oh, yeah, I've lived that. I know exactly what he's talking about, and that's my twist on it. And she said something like, you know, finding out that Sam had fathered my child. And I said, well, I'm not sure if legally I can say Sam himself fathered my child, but she is from the Kinnison family. And I know it's not the oldest brother, Rich. I know it's not the second oldest brother, Bill. And Sam was the only one that had a key to my house.
Well, I wonder how what's the lag time between something awful happening and being able to make jokes about it.
For me, I mean, some of these jokes are just popping up now, and I've been in this, you know, journey for 15 years. The other side of it is, you know, I've always been quick-witted and able to turn it. I think we have to laugh at our hell sometimes because it's too hard to live in 24/7, you know, it's just too hard, and you get one shot at life. This is it. This is the one life you get, and I don't want to be defined by the tragedies that I've had to go through, and I don't want to be defined by the hell I've had to live through. It didn't define me. It didn't kill me. It didn't take me away. I've only grown from it and understood more about the people and humans and a young woman who's searching to find out her identity. Those things have become more important to me. So I not that I laugh them off, I absorb them. And then in that, I get a twist on a joke. I get a sense of humor about it because I know that so many people are going to depend on me for that sense of humor when they come to see my shows. And I don't want them to see a guy who's been defined by pain. I don't want to be an angry comedian. I'm not. That's not who my parents raised. They raised me to handle these problems. I just didn't know it when I was lost. Now that I've gotten through it, I'm handling it the best I can with the gifts I've been given. And I know what I'm doing it for. Yeah.
Good for you. Carl, what would you say specifically? I'm going to ask you two questions specifically to somebody who's going through exactly what you're going through now, not on a celebrity level, but just,
no.
You know, average Joe, average guy out in the middle of Iowa going through what you're going through. What would you say to them right now to keep them going, to keep them motivated, to keep them positive?
Well, the thing that changed my life is I realized I had to get rid of the anger. That's the hardest thing to do because you can't think clearly when you're angry all the time. You go to work and you don't give a good day's work. You can't prosper because your mind is blocked, and it's all full of anger because of something that has happened to you. But, you know, something happens to every single one of us in life. We all get a cross to carry. That I've learned. Nobody gets out of this life without a cross. Everybody gets it. And so how do you handle your tragedy? How do you handle these situations that pop up? And for me, it was to embrace it almost and say, this is not going to change who I am. I'm going to look at this differently than how I've been looking at it, and I'm going to put joy back into my life. And I think when you do that, it's just weird. Life kind of opens up the right people in your life. I got the right help as far as communicating with other people that were going through the same thing I was. I went through a couple of family groups, and I listened to other people share their stories and realized, you know, oh, my gosh, I'm not alone. And surrounded myself with people with integrity and that were doing something about it. And I think proactive is better than sitting there taking it.
Absolutely.
And in proactive, you find something. It may change your life completely. You may fall in love with the law or trying to change the law. You may fall in love with children on a whole new level where you want to do things for children that have been abandoned. You might find your cause by doing something positive. And that's what saved me. You can only sit in your mire for so long. It's being proactive. That's the thing that changed my life.
That's a, what terrific advice. And I will tell you that all of those things you said, if for somebody who's trying to get to the level where you are now, Michelle, Judge Michelle, has a terrific book called The Good Karma Divorce, which has chapters on all of those things that you were just talking about, betrayal and anger and forgiveness. And all of those things are addressed in this book. And boy, I just encourage anybody who's listening to take a look at it to try to help them get to the level where Carl is right now, because this is so much better than I've heard you in such a long time. And
yeah.
I'm so glad that you are where you are in this place right now.
And you know what?
Thank you. Yes.
You know what you really is your other calling? And you may have, this may have occurred to you, and you may be already on that road, but a motivational speaker who also has humor is and who has had suffering is the trifecta. So when you're not in the mood to be funny, go there and talk to people. This is really important. This is what people need to hear, and they need to hear people coming out of the other side of the needle.
Yes.
They need to know that even though it's a tsunami, you can still live and find joy in life.
And you can still live and recreate and start that new house and start that new neighborhood and start that healing. All those things are there. And I'm in the middle of my case. I just started this ball game. I don't know where it's headed, but what I like about where I'm at now is I'm fearless. I have the proof that I've been looking for my whole life to clear my name. And now I have it. And I know that it's going to affect the lives of Angelica and myself. And it's going to right a wrong that's been sitting on my shoulder for so very long. So I'm in a great place just because I changed my life years ago with my mind, and that has now translated into the right people in my life. Thank you so much for this opportunity to do this show.
And I see you presenting
you
a program
show
with her, and so that she could talk about what it's like to think you have a father who's not around.
I absolutely
and maybe you know reach out.
Carl, if you and Helen could get together,
be really
do a program.
Well, we'll work on that for the next one. I'm going to try to get her name first, and then I'm sure she'll be free to talk.
Well, you know, everything in its time.
That's right.
Carl, where are you coming up? Where can we see you? Where can our listeners hear your wonderful comedy?
Well, 12 minutes from now, I'm going to be on stage at the Hilton Head Comedy Club in Hilton Head. My ride just showed up to pick me up.
Right,
Next week, I'm at the Riviera Hotel in Las Vegas, starting on Monday for a whole week. And then 2 weeks after that, I'll be in Reno, Nevada at Catch a Rising Star at the Silver Legacy.
You have a website.
Can go on Facebook. My website's being built right now, so they can go to my Facebook page, Carl LeBove, and I start putting up my dates there. And people can ask me questions also, and I love to talk to everybody, so it's no big deal.
Oh, perfect.
Well, Carl, thank you so much for coming, taking time. Go do your wonderful show. Be as funny as you possibly can, and I know that's really funny. And I'm looking forward to you coming to Illinois because we want you back here. So come over and see me all night.
I love your humor. It is so irreverent, I might add.
Yes, very much so.
Very much so. Ladies, thank you so much for the most enjoyable hour.
Angel on the show, he is not.
Yeah. This hour went by so fast. Thank you so much. I haven't been loved by two women like this in a very long time. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, Carl, we'll have you on again, and I'll talk to you soon. Love you. Have a great show tonight. Break a leg.
Thank you so much, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Michelle, I will talk
to you. Announce my seminar?
The seminar? Your seminar. Absolutely talk about your seminar. Let's hear about it.
It's going to be April 17th and 16th and 17th, Saturday and Sunday, at the Hyatt O'Hare. And it's going to be free, and it's 1 hour on the Good Karma Divorce. And you have to sign up to goodkarmarelationships.com.
And also they can access it through your Facebook account as well. Yes. And so everybody who wants to hear how to have the right kind of divorce and after divorce, come and hear Michelle at the Chicago O'Hare Hilton, April 16th, 17th. We want you there. That would be outstanding. And remember, Parental Alienation Awareness Day is April 25th. And for information on what's going on for that day, you can access our website, www.paawareness.org. Go there, see what you can do to be involved in Parental Alienation Awareness Day. Michelle, love you.
Love you, too, and hope the Look of Love is continuing to do fantastic.
Oh, it does great. I got another check. I'm so excited. I donated back to PAAO. I'm so
excited. I know
you do. Oh, hang in there.
Come
I'll
on.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Journey up the mountain is all about the climb. Love comes in all different shades of gray, not only black and white. This one just didn't work out the way I thought it should. Been a hard-earned lesson I've learned. I wouldn't trade if I could. For all the good.